Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
The following podcast is a member of the Great Big Owl family.
Hello and welcome to This Is Your Laugh, the podcast that interviews well-known female stand-ups and comedy actors about what comedy has taught them about life. This podcast is brought to you by Comedy 5050, and we're your hosts, Roxy and Alice. Our guest today is stand-up comedian, actor and writer Tiff Stevenson. Tiff has enjoyed a succession of sell-out shows at the Edinburgh Festival, which have been showered in five stars and critical acclaim. As a stand-up, her TV credits include, to name a few, Russell Howard Stand-Up Central, The Apprentice You're Fired, Mock the Week, Nevermind the Buzzcocks and Show Me the Funny, in which she performed in the live final at London's Hammersmith Apollo to millions of viewers.
Tiff began her career in the entertainment biz as an actress and has graced our screens in a host of comedy cult classics, from mockumentary sitcom The Office to People Just Do Nothing, Roisin Conaty's Game Face and Comedy Central's Drunk History. She also popped up in Dizzy Rascal's Dirty Cash video, which is a pretty cool claim to fame, and regularly writes for the newspaper The Metro. She describes herself on her website as amazingly funny human, prone to hyperbole, only the first half of which is, of course, true. Tiff, thanks for coming on the show.
Thanks, you flatter me. Well, that does sound like a slightly out-of-date biog, but I like it. Well, only when it sort of mentions things like The Apprentice, which I did about 5 years ago. It's a good smattering, because a lot of the time, if I get recognised when I'm out and about, because I've done such a wide variety of stuff, people often don't know what they know me from. So then they think that I'm a neighbour or someone from their work.
Oh, no.
So they sort of go, I know you. And I go, no. Like, one guy came up to me recently and went, you went to Middlesex University. And I was like, no. He's like, you did, though. And I was like, no, I definitely didn't. And I don't want to go, no, it's because you've seen me on TV.
So you leave them hanging.
Or recently, I was on a retreat and a lady there recognised me. She was like, you work with Karen, don't you? And I was like, no, I don't. And she was like, oh, my God, I'm so embarrassed. I've seen you on Mock the Week. It was really funny. And I was like, no, it's totally fine. That's what people do all the time. You know, they have a moment. Or they say, what do I know you from? And I say, I'm not going to do my entire CV for you because that's very tedious.
Yes.
Oh, God.
So it's, yeah. But that sounds like me complaining. But I feel like that biog is a fair summary because, you know, I'm across a few things. So sometimes I'm not a person that you can sort of place instantly. There's just a vague knowingness.
Well, actually, it's interesting you said you're across a few things because one of the things that did strike both of us when we were researching you was how many strings you have to a bow. And that's something that we have sort of toyed with a lot with the sort of various disciplines that we do. And
multi-hyphenate
business cards.
That's what they call it in America. They introduce, Tiffany's a multi-hyphenate.
They say
that. And it's a positive thing in the States. It's seen as less so here.
Yeah, why is that?
I don't know. I feel like they like to put you in a box in the UK of like what you're capable of doing and how they see you. And it's tricky to get out of that. Whereas in America, they're just, you know, you can have fingers in as many pies. You can have pie smeared fingers. because at any given time, you need to be juggling three or four different projects and then one of them might come off. Yeah. And, you know, you're sort of, my friend Chappie called Sandy always describes showbiz as feast or famine. We're sort of always in this constant state of like everything's happening or nothing's happening. Yeah. So you've got lots of things kind of percolating away. And, you know, podcasting then essentially makes you kind of a broadcaster terms. So that's another thing you could kind of add on. You know, I've just launched a podcast with Lush. So I'm like, oh, now I'm a podcaster as well. So it just, but of course, it's still in the vein of what I'm doing. I'm being funny. no matter what medium it is across, apart from when I'm being serious, which is occasionally in acting or sometimes with articles. Broadly, it's all art.
Yes.
They're just kind of different formats and different ways of presenting it. Yeah, we get very hung up here on like what people are and how they do things.
Life gets more confusing, doesn't it, as you get older? Because you used to go home at Christmas and see your family and they'd say, how are you getting on? How are you doing? You say, yes, I'm doing X. And then the years progress and then it's X, Y and Z and then all the other letters of the alphabet and suddenly you're just like, I'm good, I'm fine, thank you.
Well, no one really does, there's no such thing as a job for life anymore, is there?
Mm.
And lots of people do more than one thing. That's outside of the entertainment and arts industries. Just across lots of things, people are working multiple jobs because there's 0-hour contracts now and kind of people working from home and freelancing, doing all kinds of different things. So I think the days of just doing one thing and doing it extremely well, you know, are sort of gone, really.
Yeah. Do you ever resent having to do more than, are there times that you would like to just focus on one discipline?
Well, when I'm in one of them, I try to focus as much as I can on the one thing that I'm doing. So if I'm in something, if I'm in the process of writing one of my scripts, for example, I try and be in that as much as I can. But then, you know, gigs are in the evening, so during the day, I'm writing on an HBO show at the moment.
Oh, brilliant.
So that, you know, a lot of the time during the day I'm writing on that, and then I'm doing gigs in the evening. And then next week I'm doing Mock the Week, so the day before that I'll have to be kind of reading all of the news and getting myself prepared.
Crash course.
Wow. So I allocate periods of time, you know, it's very... I'm having to be more and more conscious with my time and good at scheduling and focus. And a friend of mine introduced me to the Pomodoro technique, which is a...
like the tomato.
Yeah, and it's a timer and you can do these focus bits of... You focus for 20 minutes, you try not to be distracted by the internet or anything else, and you do a focus 20 minutes. I think it would be good for sex as well. The Pomodoro technique, so you don't get distracted.
Sounds
but yeah.
sexual.
So I kind of feel like when people become parents... Often, you know, I see mothers, they become very streamlined with their time. So I just feel like when you're working across a few things, you just need to be able to do that and then work in time to relax and take a break from it all.
Do you feel like a different person in each different thing that you're doing? Because I think, you know, if you're writing, that requires one aspect of your personality, perhaps. And when you're doing stand-up, you're tapping into something else.
The only time I feel like it's kind of not in me is if I'm writing a piece of character-based comedy, because then I can detach myself from my political views and ideologies and be quite playful. Sometimes that's really freeing, actually, if I'm writing one of my scripts or this one that I'm working on at the moment, to just not be tied to my beliefs and my ideas and actually be funny in a very different way. But the rest of the time, kind of who I am, obviously... infiltrates the work and my ideas and you know, just sometimes different formats are better ways of getting ideas across. Sometimes I write something and I think, no, that's a bit of stand-up, or I write something else and I think, no, that would be a good short film, or that would be a good sketch, or that would fit really well into an article, but I'm not sure if it's stand-up, you know. So sometimes just thoughts and ideas. I'm always keeping notes in my iPhone, and I didn't update them, and I lost about 1,000 of them last year. I think there's some way of recovering them on my laptop still.
Yes,
hoping.
Yes, just so there is.
But yeah, but I tend to go into my iPhone notes and I write bits. Sometimes it's bits of dialogue or something that I'm on the bus and I think I'm looking at someone, or I'm looking at a couple and I think, oh, they're the kind of couple that look like they do this. They go to this thing on a Wednesday night, and I'll write, you know. So that's a little writing experiment, actually. Sometimes I'll go out in my car. This is a totally separate and not the question you asked me. But sometimes I'll drive out in my car and I probably look like some kind of spy. But I go out in my car and I drive to a place sort of nearish me that I haven't been before, like a street. And I'll drive down the street and I'll look at the houses and I'll write like a little paragraph on who lives in each house.
Oh, that's a really good exercise.
So that's like a really nice starting point for like characters. Who lives on this street? You know, this couple here, they've been married for this amount of time. And I try and gauge it from, and I could be completely wrong, but there is no wrong or right, because I'm never going to find out who lives there. But I sort of try and gauge it from the outside of the house and what's in the window and how the garden looks and who they are. And I sort of do that sometimes. And that's quite a nice, almost like meditative, separate way of like trying to come up with stuff
and keeping it really real and grounded as well, if you're taking your inspiration from real life. Because I imagine you can sit there in a coffee shop at your kitchen desk, whatever it is, and try and create a real fully fleshed person. And sort of all the elements you're pulling are from your imagination, but they may not tie together. And if you're sort of seeing real things from influences from real life, I imagine that's... Because yeah. how do you...
I'm copying from the world.
Yes. Yeah.
But I had someone in one of my shows, a guy who I eventually called Herb. I don't know what his name was, but he was a tour guide in New York. And this became like a big routine in my Bombshell show, because he was on the High Line with a group of tourists. I don't think he was professional. He had about like 15 people. But the way he was tour guiding was, he was like, okay, everybody, a little bit of history for you now. And he goes, over here is Pier number 37. This is where the Titanic was supposed to dock. We all know what happened here. Tragedy. Anyway, moving on. And that was literally how... And I became fascinated. I was with my now fiancé and my friend Steve. And I was like, that's straight in the notes. And I don't know what I'll do with him or what he's going to mean or who. And then he just became this fully kind of... It became this arc in my show, which was about how we're so bombarded with news and horrific things that you can barely acknowledge them as a human being before you have to, you know, moving on, tragedy, you know.
Oh, yeah, totally. So, the disconnect, because it's sort of the only thing you can do some days, you feel.
Yeah. And so that man doesn't know that he then became like an entire 20 minutes in my show of imagining him and his life and the things that he would get angry about. I imagined that because he didn't care about big things, he really cared about small things, you know. And so that I sort of created this, hung this sort of show around him and this routine. But that was just from hearing him do that sort of line. So for me, quite often sitting indoors trying to write doesn't work as much as being out in the world and just watching people, observing. And that's what stand-up is as well. We're observers. Women are observers. We're observers of history and moments. And
just on that note, how much do you think you can then steal from yourself? So have you ever had it where you've used up something in, I don't know, like an article, and then you think, oh, actually, I really want him for a whole character in my sitcom. Do you think you can then take it?
Yeah. I mean, self-plagiarise.
Self-plagiarise, exactly. Yeah, okay.
Yeah, I think you can. I mean, if I feel like I haven't exhausted the possibilities of that, or can I put it into a different vessel or something, you know, along those lines. But I found him fascinating. It might be down the line I write something with someone who's a tour guide, maybe not him, but somewhere else, and I kind of, you know, build a character up from there with different elements of different people or an overheard piece of conversation.
Yeah.
So has anybody from your, I suppose, your immediate family and friends who you may have taken inspiration from, have they ever come to see a show and identified, that's actually something I said, or that's something I do?
A lot of the time, if it's something like that, if I'm the butt of the joke or I'm the idiot, I'll say who it is. It'll be like my mum or my dad or my partner, because he's, you know, he's funny and smart. So sometimes he'll get a... But I normally say it's them. So I don't really, like, kind of take any of their, like... smarts to use for myself, if that makes sense.
Yeah, that's very honourable, actually.
So I'm trying to write the funny from my perspective if I'm bringing them in, but obviously the funny from Herb comes from the fact that he says that, and I kind of do the voice of how Herb sounds, you know. So that's sort of what makes that funny, and the wider context of the show. But a lot of the time, I think, if you take traits from people or you write them into your scripts, a lot of writers would say you'd be astonished how many people don't recognise themselves. Because how you see someone is often very different from how they see themselves.
So we interested Steve, is that the guy? Recognised himself. Herb.
Maybe. Steve was my friend who was there, actually. Steve sent me a video the other day saying, oh, here's a tragedy. I think he's doing a tour around the East Village. And it was a little video. So I was like, I wonder if I could put that up. Or whether it would upset him.
Yeah. I really think you should go and find Herb and just say, I've based this whole thing around you. Yeah. You know, here's some free tickets to the show.
I think people are so flattered, actually, aren't they? Often
definitely.
And he's definitely not called Herb, but that was the name I gave him.
Oh, well, yeah. Okay, fine. That's
Herb
very disguised.
Herb and Patty. His wife, Patty, who made him like egg sandwiches that were too moist. Like, and that became a whole thing of it as well. So
that's,
I just created
very visceral.
These,
yeah. So in terms of taking influence from famous people and other comedians, was it somebody that inspired you to go into comedy in the first place, or something? Or
my sort of inspirations to get into stand-up, my inspirations to do acting or funny acting, I suppose, was Victoria Wood. That would that would be someone who I looked at and went, oh, you can be funny like this. And when she used to do Kimberly, or I'm looking for my friend Kimberly, and I would watch, you know, and then I'd watch her stand-up, but I didn't think stand-up was something I could do. I think because it was done in an audience with style, so I didn't recognise it, even though she was, that's what she was doing.
Mm.
It was kind of an audience with. So I used to watch that with my mum. And then Lily Savage. Mm.
Yeah.
Paul O'Grady doing Lily Savage. Lily Savage and Gail Tuesday was an early influence. I did a character called Savannah Dior, media whore. Who was like a footballer's wife who'd like shag loads of footballers. And I did like... That was a character that I did for about 6 to 9 months before realising that I was trapped in some kind of hell that I couldn't get out of in club scenarios. I think it's much easier now probably to do character stuff, and the environments of stand-up have very much changed since I first started. But I would say stand-up as I do it now, probably the biggest influence was Joan Rivers.
Oh, yeah.
You know, because I'd watched Eddie Murphy, I'd seen all that American stand-up, but it wasn't really until I saw Joan doing it. So, you know, like if you can see it, then you can be it. And I saw Joan Rivers doing it. I was like, oh, I can, you can do stand up like that at the Apollo in front of people and be real and be really funny. And she's always very connected with the audience and with the audience and not separate to them, which I always really liked about Joan. You know, they would all be brought in, and I'd watch some of the male stand ups and they wouldn't do that as much. So it was sort of seeing Joan and, you know, people like Phyllis Diller later on. But really in the beginning, it was Joan.
In terms of your stand-up, I mean, we're both huge fans of it.
Oh, thanks.
I think what's really amazing about you is that you cover a really broad range of subjects, and you quite rightly don't shy away from the big important ones like, you know, the political climate and feminism, abortion, gay rights. And so how do you approach your stand-up material when you're writing? Is it sort of a case of exploring what subjects are immediately funny, or is it more thinking about what you possibly want to talk about, which is more serious, and maybe perhaps what people should be discussing, and then finding the funny within it?
It's about 5 years in, I knew I could make people laugh, and it stopped being about, can I just make people laugh? Can I make them think, you know, can I still be really funny, but can I challenge some stuff at the same time? So then it became about, became more about what did I want to talk about. Also, you know, more and more stand-up is appearing and I don't want to be talking about the same things that everyone else is talking about. Mm. I like to always sort of be ahead of that rather than on the zeitgeist. Although I think this year I'll have a couple of things that will be on the zeitgeist a bit. But
we can forgive you that.
Yeah, I tend to kind of focus in on things that I feel passionate about and that I feel that are important that we should talk about. I sort of work out how I feel about them, then I find the funny in it. That's sort of how it goes. It is sort of led by my conscience to a certain degree. Not all stand-ups work that way. You know, some people do one-liners and that's brilliant and that has its place. It's just kind of not what I want to do. What I love is kind of like, you know, that kind of passionate comedy that, you know, Richard Pryor would have done. You know, like you can have provocative George Carlins, the Joan Rivers of the world. You know, those people who are kind of doing that sort of Wanda Sykes now in America, you know, and it's why I think a lot of the women are really interesting, because we've had to get like so good just to get the same opportunities that very, very average men get. So, but that's the kind of stuff I love. I love that kind of passion and engagement. So that's normally where I start. I mean, this year's show, I'm talking about homelessness, and it's hard because, you know, you don't want people to go, well, that's a funny subject. But obviously the idea of homelessness itself isn't funny, but some of the attitudes around, like, how do we fix this, and some of the societal attitudes towards it, that's where I'm aiming my ire.
Yeah.
And you know, corporations and politicians that are not affecting the change. So that's where I try and get the funny from.
Do you think that is something you have always wanted to do? So even when you said, I think for the first 5 years, this is right, you said you were happy just to get the joke.
Yeah.
In the back of your mind was always, when I'm comfortable enough, when I'm at a certain level, I'll swap over into the stuff I actually want to do.
I don't even think it was. I think first it was just about being funny. And my stuff's always been, if I'm doing it right, like personal, political and social, you know. So it's always sort of been that. I've always sort of talked about class from the very beginning and being from a working class background. But it wasn't with any kind of real. It was more a case of like establishing my identity of who I was on stage and saying, this is who I am and this is where I come from and this is my story a little bit. And when you start in stand-up, it's sort of about telling people who you are. A little bit about me. You know, a lot of people start their stand-up with probably tell you a little bit about me.
Yeah.
And so So it was that. So then once I'd got through, and actually in the very beginning, I did it, almost the polar opposite of what I do now, which is I didn't want people thinking I was just some actress who thought that she could do stand-up. I remember seeing a review of someone going, well, they're a good actress, but clearly they're not a stand-up. So I was like, right, I'm going to put no delivery. I'm just going to write really dry, deadpan one-liners to show you that I can write jokes, you know. And it was counterintuitive, obviously, because my stand-up now, you know, is so full of character. It's inhabited by characters and people and voices and all of the performance elements go into it, because why would I hold any of that back? Mm. That's who I am. That's what I can do. So now it's all in there. But in the beginning, that was what I did. And then I wonder, was it a conscious push? I don't know, like 2011, I did a show called Cave Woman. And I think that was probably, I did Dictators the year before. And I think that was about dictators. So it was like Hitler, Mugabe, OK Magazine, Gaddafi and my mum. So I've always done this mix of personal and political. That was kind of like my second ever Edinburgh show. So I think just there, that was me trying to find that blend of being able to do stuff that's really personal about me or about being a woman, but also being able to talk about the world at large. And then the following year I did a show and I didn't quite nail it. You know, I think it was there in parts, but I would like to try and do it again or try and do it as a film. It was kind of like a sliding doors of what, because I had an abortion when I was 17, it was a sliding doors of kind of what my life could have been if I had a kid and where I would be and where I am now.
Oh, that's a really interesting conceit, actually.
So I tried to sort of do, I sort of did an attempt at that, and I think the results were a bit mixed, but I was very ambitious early on. So then that would be 2011. I think I started in 2005 doing a character, 2006 doing straight stand-up. So I was about 5 years in then, trying to get that kind of very much sort of, taking this big bold leap. Whether or not it paid off, I mean, who knows? But it's all learning. It's all. I don't regret it, because it's all learning, and it all leads towards, you know, becoming better and better.
Essential do you think it is that comedians lay themselves bare? Because it is very exposing, and to use real facts from your actual life, you know, it's amazing, because you'll have people really relate to you, and it makes it real, and it makes you very informed, well informed, to say the things that you say and find the funny in them. But are there any repercussions, or does it affect you outside of comedy, the fact that you have given your personal stories out to the world?
I think in different ways. I guess in the first instance, something like the abortion story, the first thing I had to deal with that was knowing that my dad was going to come at the Edinburgh Fringe and he didn't know about it.
Right.
So I sort of had to sit him down and go, look, there's this bit in the show that you don't know about, so I'm just giving you a heads up before I talk about it on stage. So there was that. That was the first kind of, oh, we've got to get over that.
Did you have to, as you were writing it, almost pretend he wouldn't be watching the show at some point?
I just didn't even think about it.
Right.
I didn't even think about it. I just sort of...
Put your professional hat on.
Yeah, there was a kind of like extended metaphor about mice in the show. There was a story about us having mice and there was some link with the Sarah Jessica Parker film. I'm really trying to remember it now. This scene with her... this film with her and Hugh Grant, where he says, how do you know I'm ready to be a father? I can't, it was like Meet the Morgans or something, I can't remember. And she says, oh, I saw you rescue this mouse and you put out a box of Cheerios for it. And you like, it's this whole very long story. She goes, and I knew then you were ready to be a father. And then I talk about when we had mice and my boyfriend shooting them from the kitchen with a BB gun.
Oh, wow.
Okay, yeah. Or hitting them over the head with a shoe. And again, I was thinking, is he ready to be a father? Like, so I had this kind of dual story. I had that story, and then I used that sort of as a metaphor for, you know, what about the baby mice, and is she ready to be a mother? You know, I'd done this, God, reaching back into my memory to try and remember exactly how I did it.
Yeah.
But it was slightly shrouded. But yeah, I didn't even think about it. It was only when I realised he was coming up to Edinburgh and I was like, well, I either take this bit out of the show or I say it's here and that's that. And then also then that opened it up so that 2 years ago when the... Not 2 years ago, it was 2017 I wrote the piece, but the referendum happened in Ireland, that I was able to talk about that and I wrote a piece for The Guardian, which was less comedy and much more kind of the realness of the experience and everything that goes with it. And that, I got overwhelmingly got support and lots of men getting in touch going, I went through this with my daughter and thank you for speaking about it. And
oh, wow.
And lots of really, and some male comics going, read this, because if you're going to talk about this stuff on stage and be flippant about it, you should understand, you know, which was really lovely. And then it went to some sort of alt-right groups in America and some Christian groups. And then I got called a murderess and I was like, sure. you know, and people sort of started tweeting vicious stuff at me. And then my mum was like, I think you've talked about that enough now. I think you should just stop talking about that. And that's the only time she's sort of done that. And then weirdly, even though the show that I'm writing this year is called Mother, I was like, do you know what? I'm not going to do reproductive rights this year because I do it almost every show. And then I was like, well, here we are, Alabama, Missouri, Georgia. More importantly, and not to say that America isn't important because I have a 3-year visa to be there, but what's happening in Northern Ireland or the Republic of Gilead, as I'm now calling it, what's happening here on our own doorstep, our own house isn't in order, so... I've got a fundraiser. I've put together a fundraiser for that. That's coming up. And I'll talk about it again. I'll talk about it in the show. And Womb Bothering will come back and it'll be 10 to 15 minutes in the new show because I feel like if there's a year that it's important to talk about it, it's this year. So, absolutely. Sorry, Mum.
No, it's what you said, yes, you've been ahead of the zeitgeist and suddenly it's like, oh, yeah, right, you're going to have to do it then, yeah.
Well, and so that's one thing that's happened there. So that's, you know, people have strong responses to that. And I've also had some people say they're going to boycott some pro-life, or as I prefer, anti-choice groups, saying that they were going to boycott the show. And obviously I'm devastated that some people who are never going to come are planning to boycott it. But interestingly, because I'm talking about homelessness in the show, there will be a big parallel between these kind of pro-life people who I'm going to stop calling pro-life and start calling pro-homeless. Because I don't know how, where are they when there are humans? You know, they're desperate for these fetuses or, you know, zygotes or whatever you want to call them, you know, bunch of cells. They're desperate for those to become babies and be born. And they want to control all of it until it comes out of the mother and then they don't care. So there's quite a nice sort of parallel to be drawn in the new show. The other thing of sort of speaking up is when you speak about stuff that happens within the industry, and then by speaking up, you can be stonewalled and punished for being a person that speaks up, or if you bang a drum and make some noise for a to make a change about something, then they're a bit like, oh God, you know, she doesn't shut up about that. So, you know, like I've definitely like spoken up about various panel shows and stuff and their lack of...
Booking
women and stuff like that, you know. And, you know, there's a couple like, you know, that still aren't doing it.
Well, I thought you were fantastic. Was it Andrew Marr show that you went on? Is it right? Was it Andrew Marr show?
Was it Matthew Wright or was it the... audio clip or a TV clip?
No, it's a TV clip.
Yeah.
Is it Andrew Marr? I can't remember. Yeah. One of those. And you were fantastic on that. I really just thought, you know, you had a wonderful way of putting your point across, being incredibly fair, very balanced, you know, just absolutely getting the sort of, the balance of passion, but also, you know, just being very relatable and friendly and, you know, not making it super heavy, but just a very accessible thing that we have to talk about, you know?
Yeah. And, you know, I do a few of them. You know, I do Mock the Week and 8 out of 10 Cats and stuff like that. But last time round, they did a big interview about Have I Got News For You? And it was about sort of female politicians not wanting to go on, about women not wanting to go on again. And, you know, I've spoken out about that. And then I kind of go, oh, is that why I haven't done that show? Because I've sort of been like, you're not very good
keep
at booking.
Banging the drum. Yeah.
You're not very good at booking women. Like, but then obviously they go, because they say they try and book women. And so my response to that is, when you say you try, it means you picked up the phone and you rang like 4 of the most famous women, not even necessarily stand-ups, you know, TV presenters as well.
Yeah.
Or sketch comedians or just actors, you know, like, and you asked them and they said they can't do it, or they don't want to, or it's too risky, or whatever. And then you go, we are some women.
Yeah.
And that is incredibly frustrating to me. So that was the only point I was trying to make. And then, of course, the piece in The Independent, they were like, have you done the show? I was like, I've never been asked to do the show. I've never been booked to do the show. I'm a political comic. So for me, that's, you know, but there are, and, you know, they don't have to book me, but there are like plenty of other political comics as well. And also that's a show, I guess, where they can get away with not having a female comic as often as a female comic. A lot of the time it'll be a journalist, but it'll be four funny men and a journalist.
Yeah.
You know, like it will be. So, and then they go, women aren't funny on this show. And you go, is it Camilla Long's job to be funny? Like, she's a journalist. Yeah. It's not, you know, is it this MP's job to be funny? And the whole issue of MPs on the show, that's a different thing, you know.
Well, and you get Anne Widdecombe, who's unwittingly funny for all the wrong reasons.
Yeah. But I think it was when they put a handbag on instead of Nicky Clark, was it? He was supposed to be on 1 week. And I was like, I get the joke, because there was the tub of lard, John Prescott thing. But what's actually happened here is you've just not got a woman on the show.
Yeah.
You just don't have a female presence. And I think, you know, and I think sometimes like being vocal about that can make people go, well, we're not going to put her on the show. Because I remember hearing Jenny Eclair talk about it, actually, on Woman's Hour, I think it was. They had someone on who was producing the show, and they were saying, look, we try and get women on, and, you know, they're just not available. And then the host of the show, I think Jenny Murray, was like, well, Jenny Eclair's just tweeted in to say she's never been asked. And then the producer said, yeah, but Jenny Eclair's not everyone's cup of tea. To which the response is, but is Brian Blessed? Is Brian Blessed everybody's cup of tea, you know? Yeah. And Jenny could more than hold her own on that show. She's a Perrier-winning comic, you know? So when people are saying they're trying, they're not really trying that hard. They've got a few people that they want to book, and then they don't really go outside of that. And I think that needs to change. I think it's really sad that we're still in this sort of place. And I think as well that there are a bunch of female comics, I mean, Zoe being one as well, and people like Sarah Kendall and Joe Caulfield and people like this, who have been brilliant for ages and should probably get reparations for all the stuff they sort of missed out on, really. I mean, they may not say it, but I think they deserve it, you know.
Yeah,
I think the Janie Godley's
to Have I Got News Joni, for You.
Yeah. Right, yeah. And Zoe has been phenomenal for years and been doing Mock the Week for years, and, you know, so. And I think sometimes it's even harder for women who are older, and I say that as I turned 40 last year, so I say that as, you know, there's women in their 20s and 30s who are also like trying to push and get, but I do feel like there's a generation of women who really, really worked for that, and they should, you know, they should be coming back and going, Janie did it recently, I think, but they should be going, hey, let's get some of these women who've really been amazing for such a long time against such difficult odds and give them goes.
Yeah.
In the same way that we keep, you know, we can't stop booking women when they're 40. Like, and I think that really does happen.
Yeah.
Like, I'm seeing it, you know, there are channels that go, we don't want women over, you know, 35 sort of thing. But you'll book male comics into their 40s and 50s, you know.
Do you think that comedy has made you more vocal? Do you think that you were always vocal and then comedy was your outlet to be vocal, if that makes sense?
Well, yeah, I suppose I was vocal about acting and stuff that happened in that, but I think comedy's probably worse. It won't be equal until we have a gender split, for example. So even though everyone thinks, oh, it's so great now, you're going, still two women on a panel of seven is not great, is it? You know, until we're regularly, if there's seven, if we're regularly having three and occasionally four women, then that's when we've got a sort of balance, and there's enough women out there that you can be booking people on the shows.
Whether or not, actually, in terms of how comedy has influenced your personality traits,
right?
As
well, I've always been outspoken. My first sort of feminist sort of moment of rage was when I was about 14, and I was sat in my bedroom listening to Capital Radio, and an advert came on, and it was for like radio advertising. It was on the radio for radio advertising, which is a bit meta. And the advert said, you should do radio advertising. It's cheaper than TV advertising, but it reaches more people, which means you can save money, which means you can get a faster car, which means you can get a better looking secretary. It was like that. And I was like, and I heard it and I was like, oh my God, I was so shocked. I was like, that just makes me think, they think that there's no women in positions of power that would want, you know, radio advertising because they've geared that towards men, and that can't be true, can it? Cry. But yeah, so that was my first sort of moment of going, oh, they treat us differently, or they they assume we don't have power, and then the gradual realization that we didn't have power. Yeah. So yes, I've always been outspoken.
What other traits have you got specifically from comedy, do you think?
Because I'm not really someone who, I'm not really on all the time. So I can kind of do a serious conversation with people without the need to, I don't have a compulsion. Although to do this as a career is a compulsion, but I don't have a need to compulsively be the funniest person in the room at a dinner party. I don't feel that kind of need. I'll be funny, but I'll be, I'm not coming out to kind of do that. And there are some people who can't
switch it off
or let a space in a conversation if someone's being quite serious without coming in with a gag. Yeah. And you're like, oh, actually someone's being quite heartfelt and emotional here. And this is an evening of wine with the girls, you know, like, or whatever.
Yeah.
So there are, you know, but I'm trying to think.
Well, because you have your acting side of things as a comedy actor as well. And you've played many different roles within that. I mean, are there any sort of, I suppose, even from your characters, are there traits that they have that you've sort of thought?
I think maybe my sort of, it has led me to be the kind of person that I guess will step in social situations a bit more because I talk about them so much on stage.
Yeah.
So I've always stuck up for myself, but recently there were two girls on the train getting harassed late night on my way home, and one of the girls recognised me. And she did this thing of like asking me questions, which I know, as women know, is code for like,
help me out.
Help me. I'm trying to strike up a conversation. And it was about my handbag. And there was a very, very drunk man who was like, where do you live? Do you want to come back to mine? Where do you live? And then she was like, I like your handbag. Where's it from? And I was like, oh, I got it in America. And she went, were you touring there? Yeah. Were you doing shows? And so that's when, and she said to her friend, she's that really awesome comedian we follow on Twitter and stuff. And then as well, I knew that like, I couldn't not step in because also they'd recognize me. So it was like a pressure there, but not a bad pressure. But he was annoyed that they were talking to me. And then he sat down and started going, so where are you getting, where do you live then? Where do you live? What, do you want to give me your number? You know, all of this kind of thing.
Oh, God.
And I just leant in and went, dude, they're not interested. And then obviously that led to an explosion of narcissistic rage from this guy whose ego was dented. And he was screaming at me, I bet you think you're some kind of feminist. Like, how dare you? What do you think I was trying to do? And I was like, well, you stop asking them where they live. They're women traveling on their own at night. They don't want to talk to you. He's like, I'm gay. And I was like, number one, don't believe it. Number two, bringing that out as a defense now.
Yeah.
Like, it's such a weird thing. And also, I just feel like if you were a gay guy, you wouldn't be screaming at me.
Yeah.
You'd try and talk to me as well.
Yeah.
You'd be like, oh, no, it's not like, you know. So it was just, it was, it was pretty horrific. And then it was like, why were you interfering? And, you know, and then the girls tweeted me afterwards going, thank you for stepping in. And it was just, I talked about it on Twitter, but then of course there was Didn't Happen of the Year awards and, you know, all of these things.
Yeah,
they come up every time and you're like, why? When women talk about their experiences, is there just this automatic assumption that we're lying? And also I reserve the right to do that in my stand-up, and if I'm making a joke on Twitter, it'll be clear that I'm making a joke.
Yeah.
But I do also talk about real stuff. And there was no joke there. They were just like, leave women alone when they're travelling at night.
Definitely.
It's not a time to chat us up.
Yeah.
It's actually terrifying for you to approach us.
Moving on to slightly more... maybe slightly ridiculous things, or it sounds it. I mean, it sounds absolutely amazing, and I wish I'd seen it. You did Celebrity Autobiography.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, which for our listeners, I believe is a show where you had to read out pretentious or sort of banal paragraphs from celebrities' autobiographies.
Yes, real stuff, unchanged.
Yes, to an audience, and you had David Tennant there, Sally Phillips was there. Lots of other people. Who else was there? Lots of amazing, famous people.
Oh, Michael Urie.
Yes.
James Lance.
Yeah.
George Wendt.
Yeah.
A real stellar Jennifer cast. Coolidge. Jennifer Coolidge. She did some when we were in Edinburgh. I love her. You know, Stifler's mum, and, you know, a lot of people know her as Stifler's mum, but she was also in Best it's in Show and all of those.
Yes.
Yeah.
And so what was, whose autobiography were you reading out?
I did Mr. T.
Oh, wow. That's great.
And I also did, who else did I do? Oh, we do this mashup of autobiographies at the end, which was Elizabeth Taylor, Debbie Reynolds, and Eddie Fisher. And it was all of their autobiographies because obviously Liz Taylor split up Debbie Reynolds and Eddie Fisher's marriage. So, and then obviously you've got like these kind of big, like almost like Hollywood dynasties sort of, so it was all of, and that was really great, and I was Elizabeth Taylor in that, I think. Was I Debbie? No, I was Elizabeth Taylor.
You have to do it
in
read it, yeah, as their voice.
Yeah, and then Jane, well, no, actually it's funnier when you sort of read it as you.
Okay, because
Bridget Christie was in it as well, so we didn't really do accents. I can't remember if I did, maybe I did an American accent for that one, because James Lance was Richard Burton, and I felt like he did a bit of a Welsh accent. So maybe I did an American accent for that one. But standard, just sort of reading them as yourself is the funniest way to do it. Like Sylvester Stallone was just like listing the contents of his fridge and stuff like
So, but how much of an autobiography do people actually write, or how much is it written by a ghostwriter or somebody?
I think a lot of them are written by other people with some flourishes added. Like Diana Ross's is hilarious because it is so... I mean, there's not a moment of modesty in it. I mean, good for her, though. She's Diana Ross. You know, why should she be modest?
Oh, yeah, she's got to own it.
But it's very, very hyperbolic and big and fantastic. So that, and then Tiger Woods, which all became very sexual after his sort of... all his affairs came out.
God,
so
yeah.
It's how he approaches playing golf, but it all reads as incredibly sexual.
Britney Spears' one is good as well, the Crossroads one. I read a quote that was something like... ate tuna for lunch, had a nap. Just like, boring stuff. It's like, you're Britney Spears, it's
Ivana Trump is incredible. She has like a whole thing of where she talks about taking Donald and Eric and Ivanka to the top of the mountain. And I fling them down and say, ski! And they're crying and crying. It's like the literally, it's like her guide to parenting, and it is absolutely terrifying.
Oh, it's like the opposite of helicopter parenting. Then.
Yeah.
Do it yourself. I'll see you later.
Yeah.
You said a career in the creative arts, and I love this quote. You said it's basically sitting at the poker table forever thinking, don't fold, don't fold. Remember saying that?
Yes.
Great, you did say it. So how often have you considered folding, or how, actually, more interestingly perhaps, how near do you think you've ever got to actually folding?
Oh, loads, all the time.
Really?
I think probably a few months back would be the last time I thought it.
Really, even now?
On every aspect of comedy, the writing as well as the acting and the
comedy
stand-up.
Can be frustrating. The comedy industry can be frustrating. No, not really. I mean, like, I'm doing slightly different things this year. There are some aspects, I suppose. I'm going to the Edinburgh Fringe, and I have to gear myself up for this because it's such a... it's the antithesis of everything art should be in terms of there being a competition for a prize, and there being reviews, and there being competition between people who do completely different things. And it instills this kind of competitive spirit and energy into you. And even no matter how much you try and let it go... Mm. Like, you're aware of what the award can do and what it does for people's careers and how it can help them. But you're also aware of the politics of it as well, sometimes, as to, you know, there are politics like there are with anything.
Yeah.
And then you are also going, it doesn't matter, that's not the reason I'm going. Then there's always that one day that the hope horse rides into town. And you go, maybe this year.
Bloody horse, yeah.
Yeah, maybe this year it'll be me, you know. And so to kind of go with that in mind is madness, because you are essentially, there's thousands of shows.
But you're human,
so don't know, you know.
Well, then it would be then.
So, yeah, so that like kind of, that sort of, that can be hard. Sometimes I struggle within, because they always say comedy's a meritocracy, but it's not really. So sometimes that's a struggle. And sometimes you can, that well-known saying that comparison is the thief of joy. But I have been guilty at looking around and going, oh, God, well, they're doing that and that and that. And why am I doing that? And, oh, my God, is it because I'm 40 now? Or is that going to happen for me? Or is this the da-da-da? And all these measurements that I, you know, kind of put in play to kind of go, these are measurements of success. And because it's an industry where you're working for yourself, there is no... quarterly review from your boss to tell you that you're getting it right. Or that you're doing it well. So you have to G yourself up. And sometimes, and I remember actually Bill Burr saying a similar thing on a podcast. I was like, wow, I have exactly the same. He says, well, you, one thing gets taken away, or you get a thing, or you have a job and then you didn't get the next one. And you're like, oh, I'm nothing and I'm shit. And I'm at the, you know, I'm like the bottom of the lake. And I always refer to it as the bottom of the well. Like, and you catastrophize and you forget everything you've ever achieved. And then the remedy for that now is to try, and every year I try and sit down and write what I've done that year and what I've achieved, so I can remind myself. And it's a marathon, it's not a sprint, and I'm not in competition with people. But I do feel like sometimes I'm at the poker table going, fuck it. You know, yes, like, yeah. Like,
yeah. And there's never quite, it's not that you don't get a free ride. You know, if one aspect of your life is going particularly well, we always talk about this sort of, me and Roxy always discuss this balance, this sort of internal balance of something else will take the place of the thing that you, that you may have achieved that had been your focus of that thing. I must get that thing. You've suddenly got that thing. There'll be something else to take its place that you need, you know.
Yeah. Well, we've often weirdly found that when our careers are going better, somehow other aspects of our life, like our relationships, aren't for some reason.
Yeah, it's
like
true.
I don't know. Like you
expect Bridget Jones quote, one area of your life is going well, another falls completely to shit.
Oh, right. Exactly. There we go.
Yeah. There is always a balance.
Helen Fielding. Yeah.
No, completely. That's it. I think that is.
But it's, you know, so I'm trying to take my victories and to ignore knowledge. So, oh, I might not have done Have I Got News For You, but I am writing on an HBO show.
Yes, can I talk about
HBO show?
I can. It's for Armando Iannucci, and I can say that much. So it's a new
amazing
HBO show. So that is, you know, and that's a real, like, I've never done that before. I've never written for a script that's not a script that I'm writing for myself.
Yeah.
So it's been a really, it's been fantastic, and just like an incredible person to his work is pretty much the best I could get. Like, if I was going to do this, it really is. So that's when I try and sort of balance those sort of things off. But you know, it's still enjoying doing live stand up. You know, versus TV, they're all very kind of panel shows are a different discipline again. You know, and I'm lucky enough that I do a few of them, and I go, oh, not everyone does all of the things. I try and do that, and then I go, but some people do. Some people do all of the things, you know, and you see people rock it off, and not everyone's, like I say, not everyone's climb is the same. Some people are rockets, and they go, and then they burn out, or some keep going and going, and you could be the person that's just climbing the hill a little bit at the time.
And still, if your version of yourself from 10 years ago looked at where you were now, undoubtedly they'd be like, oh, great, we're doing amazingly.
And also, it's not, you can't measure, there's no parallel between how high up the mountain you are and how high your happiness is either, I think.
Yeah, yeah. And also, within that, you have sort of no concept of how other people see you, like you say, how other people see you and how well you are perceived to be doing. But also, there is a bit of a thing in this business of you always have to say that you're succeeding and that you're always amazing.
Mm-hmm.
And that, you know, sometimes it's quite nice to be honest and go, I had a shit week.
Yeah,
I didn't get a thing I was really hoping to get, and I feel a bit sad and I feel a bit shit. And
absolutely tanked that show.
yeah. I did badly on that, and I don't know, or whatever it is, you know.
Do you let yourself say that then in a professional capacity? Or does it mean it probably depends on the person, doesn't it?
Yeah, sometimes I'll talk about it in my stand-up, or sometimes I'll, you know, talk about it on Twitter or Instagram or something. But it's very hard within the business side of it, because
yes,
you can't,
because you're your own boss as well,
because you've got to sell yourself, you've got to, you know, so that's a little bit difficult. And also there is always the just that thing of, as a woman doing any of the things, there's just this, men get the benefit of the doubt. So if you as a woman have like one that's a perfectly reasonable debut on a show, or you do well, you know, you're still sort of on trial a lot of the time. You feel like you're constantly on trial with these things, like, am I good enough? Am I good enough? When you get to go and do a thing once a year, and then the boys are doing it 4 or 5 times, you know, and you're like, oh, well, if you had me here like 2 or 3 times even, then, you know.
Yes, yeah, so there is an element of needing to back yourself actually in public, isn't there?
Yeah, and I still feel like women aren't part of the establishment or furniture enough yet to be kind of going, you know, that we should be at a point where it doesn't matter if a woman has a tough gig on one of these shows because there's 3 other women on.
Yeah.
And no one's going, women are shit if you have one bad.
Because it's too
thing.
Much pressure as well for that one woman.
Yeah.
She's so good in that,
also,
in that
probably
moment.
Probably your level where you think, that was a terrible show, that was really bad, I'm so embarrassed and I feel humiliated. It's probably still a really, really high standard, but we do have incredibly, we hold ourselves to incredibly high standards, and I think they're almost unreachable standards sometimes.
Yes.
You know, but our low is actually probably, you know, a high kind of middly range, yeah.
I think as well, that's something that happens with Edinburgh shows, because in my head I'll have a show and I'll be really annoyed if I've forgotten a bit, or it's not gone how I wanted it to, or that bit there it didn't quite work how I want, and then I have to let that go and know that they don't know what the show is. So they're just receiving a show that then they think is great, and you go over and go, well, actually it was shit because I forgot this bit and I didn't do this bit, and I really just felt the audience were really cold, you know. Like if you do stuff like that.
We had a great scenario actually, I don't know if you were there, but we walked off from a play we did at drama school. Mm. And the one of our tutors came up to us and said, great show tonight. And when it was me, I'm going to admit that it was me that said this. And I said, oh, it really wasn't good. And he said, he really told me off. He said, don't ever say that. I watched that show and I enjoyed it. What right do you have to take that away and say you weren't on your best version of yourself tonight, you know?
Oh, completely.
And I thought it was a really good lesson, actually, to learn.
And you also can't judge how well an audience have received you. Like, we did an Edinburgh show and for 2 days in a row, the fire alarm went off right in the middle of the show. I mean, at the actual center point of the show it went off, and we had to continue it outside in the courtyard in the rain, and I really thought we had lost our audience. They came back in afterwards and it felt like there was no point carrying on, but people came up to us afterwards and they said, you know, we're so glad you continued with that, like, we were really with you, but what's going on inside you is, oh my god, oh fuck, we've lost them, you know.
Well, also for them that's like an event. Like, do you remember that show we went and then it just carried on outside? There's that kind of almost like blitz spirit.
Yeah.
Off the fringe that says you've got to keep going. I got a Mervyn Stutter Spirit of the Fringe one year because a woman collapsed in the show in the middle of my set. And I sort of handled that and was this whole like,
amazing,
the show's still happening, we're going to get her out. Like, it was sort of mad. So I got a Spirit of the Fringe one year for that.
There's your award. There's an amazing award to get.
Doing but resuscitation at the same time as gags.
Yeah. Well, she collapsed when I said Hitler. So I was like, is it a trigger word? What's happening? She was fine afterwards. But it is kind of getting through it like that. And like I say, the audience might have gone, that was a real experience for us. But those are all the things in the Fringe that are like, the first ever time I went to the Fringe, I did the talk radio, the Boghossian play. And we were in that, the Purple Cow.
Okay, mm-hmm. Yeah.
And every time I would get into my monologue, like a samba band would go past. It was like a heartfelt monologue about me loving Barry Champlin. And it would just like... Da, you know, like, or whatever. No, that's Mexican.
Mariachi.
Samba. Yeah, mariachi. But yeah, it was like a samba, like, da, you know, going through the middle of my thing, always at the same point every day. So these are the things you struggle with during the Fringe. But again, you can't come out of that going, oh, you know, like, because the audience were like, we were enchanted. We didn't hear it. We didn't, you know, we were in it.
We thought it was intentional.
Yeah, yeah.
Underscore, yeah.
It's good skills for life.
Sometimes I don't feel like I'm succeeding, or sometimes I will. I've got much better at it in recent years of sort of controlling that need to compare myself, but it's not fully gone.
Well, I don't think it ever will be.
It exists in all industries, except that this one is particularly public and under scrutiny to an extent.
Yeah, and I don't want to be envious of when my friends are... I'm actually, when it's my friends, I'm normally fine. When it's people that I like, I go, oh, I'd like to. I suppose the difference between envy and jealousy, I suppose. One is that you kind of go, oh, I'd like to do that as well. Or that kind of inspires me to try and reach that. And the other is like, they shouldn't have that.
So is envy the first one?
I don't know which way around they are.
Just joking.
That's why I threw them in together.
Lovely.
But whichever way around it is, one is the thing that motivates, and the other is maybe jealousy motivates, and envy is because it's one of the sins. I don't know. Whichever way around it is.
I'm going to look this up afterwards.
Yeah, but one of them is kind of can motivate and drive you, and the other one can say they shouldn't have that. And that's different to going, oh, I want that as well.
Yeah.
That's a great thing to have, but it's like I say, it's hard when you have no boss and you have no way of knowing, you know, if it's moving.
Yeah, well, it's moving, trust us. from where we're looking at you, it's moving.
Yeah. So Tiff, if there's one thing, just to finalize, to finish up, if there's one thing that comedy has taught you about life, what is it?
Oh, failure can lead to your biggest triumphs.
That's nice. We will go out on that.
Thank you so much.
It's been brilliant. Thank you.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Hi, I'm Megan Rinks.
And I'm Melissa D. Montz.
And like every other person with access to a microphone, we started a podcast.
On Mondays, we release Don't Blame Me, which is an advice podcast where listeners call in and we share our thoughts on situations such as what to do if you're going to your boyfriend's family function and you haven't told him that you previously slept with both his twin brothers.
Then on Thursdays, we release our podcast, But Am I Wrong?, where we ethically gossip about pop culture, politics, our lives, and your lives. Listeners write in and we tell them if they're wrong or right in a situation. Are you the hero or the villain?
On Tuesdays and Fridays, we throw in a little something extra as well.
A little something, something. We strive to create a community grounded in activism, mental health, and inclusivity. Think of us as like your blunt, honest friends who give you advice that you need to hear, not what you want to hear. But we're also always rooting for your success. What we lack in credentials, we make up for in...
opinions.
We do that in every episode, too.
We're professional unprofessional, so if you're looking for a new slate of podcasts to add to your routine, we're here for you.
Acast recommends.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.